Hello and welcome to Our Food with me, Mary Brophy. Coming up on today's programme, I'll be meeting Donal Skehan and Dee Sewell to find out how social media is giving people a way to share their love of food.
Cooking was my hobby, and so in a way it was allowing me to share my hobby with others. And from that perspective, it opens you up to a world that you didn't think was there before. And that's probably why I started Food Blogging.
We talk local food with Donal Doherty of Harry's and hear about the challenges and rewards that come with trying to source and sell local quality ingredients.
The product I'm dealing with is a very raw product, but for me, the Dexter farmer is an artisan. For me, the fisherman's an artisan.
And we ask, is food security something we should be thinking about on this island and here in Donegal?
I think in the next 5-10 years, it's going to be a huge issue. Food is a global industry, and certainly with increased demand from China, India, increasing middle classes, there's going to be a huge demand on a global scale.
Welcome to Harry's. You've just come into the restaurant.
You know, very often food is about faith. Faith that this growing season will be better than the last. Faith that the dish will turn out the way you expect. But in Donal Doherty's case, food is belief in an idea and the commitment to see it through. Against the odds, he has built a menu and a reputation for Harry's Bar and Restaurant in Bridgend on food that comes almost entirely from a network of local growers, bakers and brewers in Inishowen and Donegal.
Nice dining room. We sort of modernised this in 2007. If you come on through here, you see we go for a nice, relaxed, casual rather than trying to be too formal. I think that's where we want to be with our food as well. We head over to the kitchen here. One of the best things about this is the size of a huge kitchen, and it's open-fronted. So you come into this on Friday lunch. It's funny, on Friday lunch you'll see that 75% of the orders will be fish on Friday. One of the great things we've done over the last few years is the only fish we have in here has come straight off a boat in Greencastle. No middlemen or anything else. So if we squeeze down here,
mind the back, chefs.
Simple Friday lunch dish. Mark Gibney here is a head chef.
It's all local produce. The haddock came straight from Greencastle, straight off the boats yesterday morning, I think, was it? And the beetroot's from the garden. We just made a puree of it. And then that's just a chive butter sauce. The chives are out of the garden as well.
So that simple dish, I mean, that's, you know, as low as sometimes 11 euros for lunch. Comes with your side order, potatoes, vegetables all from the garden. 100% of the ingredients on that dish is from Inishowen. And that's become our mantra, a long journey to get to this made in Inishowen idea. But now it's 100% of ingredients on that plate. Go out and we can say to people, you know, that's come off the boat called the Green Isle. Dermot harvested that this morning. Mark's put it together here. We're actually very proud of that.
Humble, please.
I swore that this would be the last place I'd be involved in.
And that was your dad that... That
was my dad, and everyone said he was absolutely mad, including my mother, which is quite funny, but it's turned out to be quite a success. And the nice thing for our family is it's kept us quite local and home, you know, because I worked the opening night here in summers here and from age of 16. And then I went to live in London, became an accountant and worked with big companies and came home kind of for weddings, to be honest with you. And there was a couple of wee things needed changed here, and they asked me to stay on for a while. And I said, well, I'll stay for a couple of months. 10 years later, we're still making changes. And there's reasons for that. I think the idea to go and source everything locally, not use middlemen, nobody was doing it. It wasn't fashionable. You know, customers didn't really care. Nobody really cared as such. And the reason we did it was we discovered that, you know, going to get local farmers' meats just tasted better once we hung them in our dry aging room. We made the revolutionary step of going to the boats and collecting the fish, which sounds simple. But again, you know, it was... There's a lot of work involved in just doing
that. It's very complicated now.
It is. So, but once we crack that, again, like the fish menu here is just taken off. We like simple food here sometimes. See, when you get an ingredient such as these are basically langoustines or Dublin Bay prawns, or, you know, basically very fresh off yesterday's boat. They were done in a garlic butter. We keep the shell on for a bit of fun, and that goes out as a, like, there's 8 langoustines. I think it's on the menu for 6 euros. We also do that in a linguine, which is going out separately. Yeah, the linguine with a wee bit of beetroot there with the prawns to give it a bit of colour. And again, it's all local.
29 away, please.
Where did the idea start that we want to get everything from Inishowen?
Okay, so the secret behind that is my accountancy background. We found that by skipping middlemen, we could get a fresher, better product at a better value. So there was a couple of reasons. And to be honest with you, it was probably... motivated more by that at the beginning. And then we realized, actually, there's a great feedback from people when they were getting this. You know, we were naming the farmer, we were naming the boat, we were naming, you know. And suddenly it was like, wow. And then it kind of became fashionable 2009, 2010, when the recession was kicking in. And what happened back then was, because we'd been doing it a few years, we got a lot of publicity in terms of, well, actually, there's a restaurant already doing all this local thing.
Trying to source everything from Inishowen, did that restrict your menu?
It probably did, yeah. So we had to say, for example, we only use wild game when it's in season. So people can come here during the summer and ask for duck. Well, we're not going to have duck because we don't know where it's come from again. And it's not wild and it's not from Donegal. The first challenge for us was the customers, because we were taking the restaurant away from a steak-based restaurant, salmon, predictable type menu, to be honest with you. Using fish like gurnard was our best-selling fish for 2 years in a row, but introducing people to gurnard was quite a shock for them because they were still all looking for the salmon. And I said, no, if it doesn't come from Greencastle, we're not going to use it. We're going to use these fish that are in abundance and nobody else was using. It means now, at different times of the year, every month, I have something new to look forward to.
With the side orders, today we're going with some nice cream Donegal potatoes. And there's a bit of a, not really supposed to say this, but there's a lot of courgettes in the garden at the minute. So that's courgettes with
cabbage, courgettes, and then tomato dressing. We add some seasoning for it. Some herbs and all as well in the tomato sauce.
So again, the only herbs in here are from the garden again.
And is that tomato sauce from the tomatoes from the garden as well?
Yeah, everything from the garden.
There's a lot of prep time in our work. We don't buy anything in pre-prepared or fact-packed or anything else. Literally everything from vegetables to fish to meat comes in on the bones and whole animals. And, you know, by printing your menus every day, you're not forced into having menu items that are either farmed or imported or stuff that, you know. Mm. So we're just totally dependent on what we have is what we sell.
The product I'm dealing with is a very raw product. But for me, the Dexter farmer is an artisan. For me, the fisherman's an artisan, as much as the person who adds value and creates a lovely product for a shelf. I deal more with the raw product people because that's, again, where I can get it at a good price and add my margin, right? Mm. And you're right, they struggle distribution-wise. You know, the small guy here struggles, but that's why we created the Saturday market. I mean, people come along to that Saturday market and we put our hands up and say, look, actually, some things here are cheaper than the supermarkets, believe it or not. And then some of the meats from Dexter Beef, which is so brilliant and it's been outdoor fed for 11 months, and you have the two Dexter ladies selling it and chatting to the customers, they don't care that it's 10% more. They would drive 50 miles to get that beef. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Now, that's a small percentage of the market. Local food has a reputation sometimes of being artisan and elitist. And to be honest with you, there is an extreme that is true in that as well when you go to fancier farmers markets and buy fancier artisan products. But again, that's a choice. And most of those are superb. And occasionally as a treat, I buy some of those as well. But the future is getting all that world-class produce of the fish and the vegetables in a more raw format available to people. The whole movement towards processed and ready-made and jarred is slowly destroying people's diets and people's healthiness, lifestyles. It is doing so much damage. And when people make a conscious choice, either through the Jamie Olivers or through the Donal Skehans or through Doreen Allens, and make a choice to actually spend in a week, even if they have to freeze down some of the stuff that they cook to have soups or anything else for the rest of the week, as soon as they make that little bit of space in their week, they will save money by not buying the rubbish that is otherwise out there.
As the accountant who came in here 10 years ago, is this still making sense? Your passion can drive you forward in a lot of businesses, but it doesn't actually change the bottom line all the time.
It doesn't, and you got to be conscious that, you know, like the 10% of people who might go to a farmer's market, there's still 90% out of there who are reliant on supermarkets. And there's maybe the majority of people don't care where the chicken comes from. And yet you're saying to them, well, this chicken's a bit more expensive because we know the farm and it gets to see outside and it's a nice chicken. I worry how many people care about that. I know my customers care, but then we're a biased bunch here because I've trained them over the years. But as every single person jumps that fence and decides, I'm going to eat something local, I'm going to buy something local, you wouldn't believe the difference. You know, literally that means me giving more checks to people in any show and passing that around. You know what I mean? It makes a huge difference.
A food blog is like a web diary of meals you've cooked or food you've grown that you put online on a website for all to see. Back in 2007, it's thought that there were only about 15 food bloggers in the whole country. Today, there are well over 500. Blogs have launched perhaps not quite 1,000 careers, but they can be big business with a large, avid audience right at your fingertips. I met community gardener Dee Sewell, who won Blog of the Year last year for her blog Greenside Up, and perhaps one of the country's most high-profile food bloggers, Donal Skehan, to find out what it takes to produce a good blog.
This carrot is a perfect example of a root vegetable that wasn't enjoying the deliciously rich soil that had been provided for it, or that it had been transplanted as a seedling. Well, I started in 2009. I'd started a business, and it was how can I encourage people to think that I know what I'm talking about. So I started the blog, and initially it was a lot more food back then, recipes and things. It was really about what we were doing at home, so what I was growing at home and what I was cooking with the produce at home. So that's 2009.
Elderflower has a short season. Elderflower cordial is a perfect pantry ingredient that bottles summer and allows you to savour the flavour long after the last flower has fallen.
Why did you decide to start the blog?
Well, I started my food blog in 2007, and I started it purely because, number one, I loved food. I mean, that was the heart and soul of it. And I just moved out to my first apartment, myself and my girlfriend, and I suppose it was a way of cataloguing the recipes I was cooking. Cooking was my hobby, and so in a way it was allowing me to share my hobby with others. And that is the thing about food blogging, is that it's such a community-driven thing that, you know, everyone gets involved. There's people that are commenting on you, on your recipes, and from that perspective it opens you up to a world that you didn't think was there before, and that's probably why I started food blogging.
And was it like, I mean, when you talk about the social media being a community, was it like sharing your passion with other people?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I suppose when I started a food blog in Ireland, there was only about maybe 10, I would imagine, 10 active food bloggers. So it was fairly small at the time, but the worldwide food blogging community was huge. You know, like, I would have gotten my inspiration from people in America. The Pioneer Woman was one of the big ones at the time. Lots of Smitten Kitchen, Matt Bites. For me, it was taking inspiration from that. And then I actually started photography at the same time as I started my food blog. So it was really a hobby, and I just loved doing it. I loved cooking recipes, taking the photographs, writing the recipes, and then sharing them with the community. And people were commenting on it. People were giving you feedback if they liked it, if they didn't like it. And you have to kind of grow a thick skin as well, because, you know, you are open. You're putting yourself on a pedestal and you're kind of going, hey, look at my recipes. Standalone mixer, cream the butter and sugar together until pale and fluffy, then beat the eggs in one by one before adding the vanilla extract. Using a spatula,
you put a post up and it just disappears into the ether, and you don't know how it's been responded to. How did you find that at the beginning?
I suppose you can see from your stats on a blog whether people are actually reading the posts, and it's a mixture of excitement and fear. Oh, somebody is actually reading this. And then you develop into a bit of a stat nerd that you just want to keep checking to see if people are reading and looking and if you're doing the right thing. So, but I've always liked writing. I've always really enjoyed writing. So it's, you know, my husband, he'll say, oh, you're working. I'm kind of, well, blogging's my work and hobby, really. It's, you know, I love to write, so.
How do you become a food blogger? What do you need to do?
So the practical side is where you need a blog. So there are a number of different ones. There's WordPress, there's Blogger, Google's Blogger. There's another one called Wix. They're free. And so you just sign up for it. And there's usually basic, good tutorials, loads of information on the internet on tips and hints. And that's it. You can just get going. And you can create it all in draft format and then just hit that publish once you're happy with it. I know a few people who would have written a lot of drafts and just never published. They just never had that go to just hit go.
And that's like the old-fashioned going to press with the print. That publish is putting it up there on the internet, and then it's live.
Yeah, that's it. And that's something, I suppose, whenever you hit publish, you don't do it flippantly. You know, I always think whatever I put up there, I have to stand behind. So if I've written anything slightly controversial or slightly naughty, then I know that I have to maybe stand behind that. So and be able to answer questions and argue my thoughts on it. So I think actually something that's shown up in certainly the last couple of years is you need good photographs to be a good food blogger, the best food bloggers. And if you look at all of the food blogs out there, the ones with the good photographs are the ones that are really the most popular. People like to see what they're eating or going to eat. And people like a bit of a story, I think, as well. They like to know perhaps where it's come from or how it's not just a recipe sitting there on a site with no background. People like that bit of a story. The only problem is, I'd say, is lots of people are doing that now. So the challenge, I think, for future food bloggers is how you can just do it that little bit differently.
I have to say, I mean, I've always been very image-driven with the sort of food blogs that I read, and I know that's an apparent contradiction, but, you know, I think it does have to be visually appealing. And for me, you know, all my food and the photographs I take, my kind of one kind of defining factor on a good blog post is the images. You know, I will spend more time looking at a food blog that it has beautiful images than I will that has one that has, you know, great writing. And I know that's terrible to say, and you shouldn't judge a book by its cover, but it plays a big part. And I think because food is such a visual medium that you have to be able to see the you know, the recipes. You have to be, it is a big selling part of the recipes. But I think, you know, at the same time, there is food blogs that I would read, you know, and there's some great food blogs in Ireland as well that you would, you know, you would really read for the content. But I mean, I think food photographs for me, you know, that is my big passion. And so it's something that will always play a big part in what I do.
That was a lot of work, though. I mean, you, from the very beginning, created a very polished product. But there was a lot of work that went into that behind the scenes in terms of what you're talking about, like and styling the food and styling those photographs.
Well, I did have the advantage that my aunt is actually a food stylist. So I had worked, I suppose my summer jobs would have been helping her out. That was my training ground in a way. Now, I didn't do so much, but certainly was an inspiration, something that I would have drawn on. That is the one thing about food blogs in general, is that it is a learning experience. You know, you go into something like that, you don't know where it's going to go, or what you may end up doing, but you learn a hell of a lot along the way. And I think that's, you know, I mean, I'm still learning, you know, even from a food photography point of view, from a recipe writing point of view. And actually, food blogs push you to be a better everything. From the very outset, you know, on my food blog, it was always to keep the recipes simple and, you know, as accessible as possible. We're doing this tour at the moment and we're going around the country cooking, and it's so rewarding to see people who have dog-eared books and they've cooked from them. And like, for me, like, because you write a cookbook or you write a food blog in your bedroom or in your office or whatever it is, and so when you're going out and meeting people who've actually used your recipes, I can't tell you how rewarding it is. I mean, there was a little young fella, he was only 10 years old, and throughout the entire show in Sligo or Mullingar, he sat at the back and took notes the whole way through. My heart was breaking. Like, it was so lovely. And I mean, I think in any job, you look for the kind of rewarding moments. And for me, that is it. Like, it ticks the box 100%.
I think generally, if you follow the blogs and if you follow Twitter, Facebook, you'll notice that it's a lot of the food bloggers are interacting with each other. They're not competing. They're actually friends. And certainly my friends now in social media, I met as a result of my blog, you know, and they've become real life friends, not just virtual friends. So it's definitely enriched my life in that respect. Yeah.
Well, next up, we're looking at a topic that you might not think a food-producing country like ours needs to be concerned about: food security. It's an issue that's back on the global agenda in recent times, with rising food prices, crop failures, and the impact of climate change on harvests, all giving governments around the world pause for thought. According to the World Food Summit, food security is defined as existing when all people at all times have access to sufficient, safe, nutritious food to maintain a healthy and active life. It's not just about access to food, but it's also about being able to afford nutritious food and have the knowledge about basic nutrition. So is food security something we should be thinking more about? Kieran O'Hanrahan of Letterkenny IT School of Tourism.
I think in the next 5-10 years, it's going to be a huge issue. You're right, food is a global industry, and we import and export huge amounts of food. And certainly with increased demand from China, India, increasing middle classes, there's going to be a huge demand on a global scale. So that in the first instance, will we be able to import wheat grains from America or Russia? We had issues, what was it, 2 years ago with potatoes, all our potatoes going to Russia because of whatever was going on. And certainly if there are people who can afford it, the prices will go up and we will have to, you know, if there are import-export markets out there, they will export to the people who are willing to pay. We have raw materials on our own doorstep. We can take almost full control over our food production.
Food security means, I think, being in charge of your own destiny. Yes, if the ports did close, what are we left with?
Donald Doherty, Harry's Bar and Restaurant, Bridge End.
Our dairy produce is the best in the world. Our potatoes are arguably some of the best in the world. And once you, and our meats are obviously some of the best in the world. But then there's a whole raft of stuff where we're not best in the world whatsoever. Mm. And we ignore them and we import them. There's other things that this country's doing, and in a mass scale driven by GAP and reform and all the rest, we are driving our farms to become bigger and bigger and bigger and produce more and more and more of singular products. You know, there's big volume and we're still doing carrots and parsnips and we're doing, but outside of four vegetables, I couldn't get Donegal vegetables. Is my other choice only to import the vegetables because they're not nice? Yeah. You know, I can get them cheap enough and I can fill a plate with them, but they're not nice. Versus trying to get skills back to, actually, let's not forget how to grow those vegetables.
How does that work on a local level in Ireland? I would think that on a very local level, we have control over our food production in the vast majority of issues, whether it be meat, whether it be poultry, fish, vegetables, fruit. We can do it all here. And if it is the situation where we have community gardens, local gardens, people growing their own, every little bit helps so that we know where the food is coming from. And I think that leads on to the second big issue in terms of food security, is the quality of the food that we are eating on a day-to-day basis.
And it's that quality or nutritional value of the food we're consuming that's impacting obesity levels, with 61% of the Irish population already overweight or obese. With recession and lower incomes, many families too are suffering food poverty. Assumpta Butler, Glora Namara.
So food security is not just about volume, it's about the nutrition as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yes. It's about the quality of food that we're eating, and obviously obesity, and a huge issue in Ireland, diabetes, all of that. And if all of these things that have started to escalate weren't there 30 years ago, we have to look at the wisdom of 30 years ago, 30, 40, 60 years ago. We think it's going to be solved with GM foods products, but what we've noticed in that situation is that the multinationals get richer, but the people on the ground are not necessarily getting a better diet, or there's not more food. It hasn't solved the poverty problem.
There are very different propositions, I suppose, in terms of nutrition and what we eat going forward, and we have to make informed choices and be happy with the choices. Are we happy to get our nutrition from a pill a day, or are we happy to get nutrition from the carrots we pull out of our back garden? Wouldn't it be wonderful if we were able to say, I know where my chicken is coming from. It's not coming out of a plastic container. It's coming from a farm, and it did have feathers and wings and legs, and we know where it's coming from. We know carrots grow in the ground, and our kids need to learn that from a very early stage, so that we're not losing sight of the quality of the food that we're eating.
And in the longer term, you're saying that local food will be cheaper.
I think certainly local food, if we are able to produce it locally, we have no air miles, we have no distribution costs, that it is grown and sold and processed locally. I think that ultimately the cost will come down. We do have to look at, as we talk about everything, we look at the critical mass, we look at how this works. But you will certainly, I think, find that locally produced, locally sourced, locally marketed, locally sold food will ultimately, once we hit that critical mass, that it will actually work out in our favour. It will become cheaper.
If we worked along with the earth, there is fantastic abundance there, and it's about, you know, moving away from monocrops, all of that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Going back, letting local people grow their own food locally. But we would have to change our diets and our demands for
not having strawberries in December.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Okay. So yeah. There would be a bit of that, you know. There's a bit of sacrifice maybe in it. Hate to use that word, but a bit of change anyway.
The more they can see that there's money to be saved, that there's better ingredients, better nutrition, better everything, and more jobs in the country, and that places like Donegal can make a new living because more people will support what we can produce just here, you know, there's be a much better future.
Lots of really interesting things to think about there, and actually perhaps Donegal is ahead of the curve on this one. Well, that's all we've got time for today. I'll be back at the same time next week, so do hope you can join me. Bye-bye.
Our Food is a Holybrook production for Highland Radio, funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with a television licence fee.